This is Ozarks at Large for Tuesday, October 8th, 2019, on your public radio station, 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. Ahead on our show today, our militant grammarian opens up the mailbag to address questions you've asked recently. We'll learn about the difference between may and might and find out when somebody is no longer the late. The militant grammarian joins us in our second half hour. After this Tuesday edition of Ozarks at Large, stay with us for Here and Now. On today's show, how do you learn to cook everything again? Mark Bittman has a sequel to his cookbook, and he says cooking everything begins with the basics, then playing with the possibilities. That conversation, plus the latest news from NPR regarding what's taking place in Washington and more, on Here and Now beginning at 1, right after Ozarks at Large. The annual Agricultural College and Career Night takes place tonight at Fayetteville High School. There will be admissions officers and financial aid experts on hand, as well as representatives from several colleges and universities, including the Dale Bumpers College of Agricultural, Food, and Life Sciences at the University of Arkansas, Northwest Arkansas Community College, Northwest Technical Institute, and Arkansas Tech University. There will also be industry representatives from Tyson Foods, Cargill, Black Hills Energy, and more. It's from 6 to 8 tonight in the FHS Agricultural Classrooms. This is Ozarks at Large. Concerns about climate change are leading to conversations about how we travel, how we eat, and how we work. Add to the list how we build. This past weekend, the University of Arkansas hosted a symposium dedicated to design excellence in timber and wood. One of the guests of the Fay Jones School of Architecture and Design was Andrew Waugh, a founding director of Waugh Thistleton Architects in London. Waugh and his colleagues championed the use of timber for construction as a way to minimize the impact on the planet. Sunday afternoon, Andrew Waugh came to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio to talk to us about his work. He says his firm takes environmental responsibility seriously.
Incredibly seriously. I mean, buildings, the maintenance, management, refurbishment, construction of buildings, it's nearly half of our global carbon emissions. So the architect bears a great deal of responsibility for, you know, for the future of the planet. Basically, you know, we have 11 years left to meet our Paris agreements or near agreements or to meet our Paris targets. We have 11 years left. And if nearly half of those are really down to an industry whose thought leader is the architect, then it really is behove on the architect to take responsibility for that.
And this goes from materials used to construction, maintenance, everything.
It does. And we focus a lot on the materials that we build with and the process of construction. The reason why we do that is because we think it's imperative that we shift the focus of a building's kind of carbon footprint or carbon burden from the operations of that building, which is what everybody talks about. So the heating, the lighting, the air conditioning. And people measure the carbon of a building over 50, 60 years based on that. But we don't have 50, 60 years. You know, we've got now, right now. And so we need to be making those massive carbon cuts in construction immediately, which means that we need to be looking at the materials and the process of construction.
We've been using concrete and steel and stone for a long time.
Yeah.
Should we get away from concrete, steel, and stone?
Absolutely. I mean, concrete is responsible for more than just the production of cement alone is responsible for more than 8% of greenhouse gas emissions. So it's the only individual thing that was mentioned in the IPCC report as a polluter. So cement itself is, you know, three times greater than airline travel as a polluter.
Oh, my goodness.
Right? And then you've got making that into concrete, transporting that. Then you've got steel on top of that. So actually, by the time you get to the production of concrete and steel combined is more than 15%. And as we get better at doing everything else, then those percentages are going to become even more important.
What can we use instead?
Timber. So we use I think timber is the most obvious answer. I mean, we also, I think, need to re-examine our whole relationship with the planet. You know, so it really is about an understanding of where we get those materials from, you know, so that we stop scraping our materials off the surface of the planet and we think about things that we can grow again, that we can grow more of. You know, a tree, as it grows, when it reaches maturity, it sheds as much carbon as it absorbs. So we need to cut those trees down, put them in buildings, turn them into carbon stores, and then plant more trees. Mm. So, you know, sustainable forestry, which is what we're talking about. We're not talking about clear-cutting old-growth forest. We're talking about sustainable forestry. Sustainable forestry increases forest growth because of the replanting that's done, because of the care that's taken of the forests. You avoid forest fires. The forests are better taken care of, so you don't have the same issues, you know, with beetles, et cetera, et cetera. So if we take care, manage our forests sustainably, then there is easily enough harvestable timber to build all of our buildings.
Okay, so if architects are the thought leaders and they can move this direction, will construction industry follow?
That's been our experience. I mean, that the construction industry, in fact, you know the honest truth of it is, the construction industry and the development world are generally more excited and interested by this than architects. You know, architects are generally, you know, they think of themselves as kind of avant-garde lot, but actually they're not. You know, in my experience, they're a fairly conservative bunch. You know, it took them a while to come around to concrete 100 years or so ago. And now they've got there, then that's, you know, all their kind of visual index is based on concrete buildings and concrete forms. So to change that practice toward a new material, which offers a new kind of, it offers a new architecture, but also a new responsibility, then I think is, you know, as I said before, behove on architects to do that. But, it is definitely a challenge.
You take this responsibility seriously, but you also take proselytizing seriously because this is how other architects can find out, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'm pretty evangelical about this. You know, we kind of like, when we built our first tall timber building, we built a 9-story building in 2008. And when we built that, you know, it was really just a conversation that I'd been having with a few people in the studio about urban housing and about low carbon, and we didn't really realize the implications of what it was that we were doing. And as we began to understand that because of the amount of questions and interest we were getting in that. And then you know, the beauty of talking about something is that you learn why you did it. Do you understand what I mean? So
yes.
It's like so much of what we do, I only know architecture, but so much of what I do in architecture, you know, you do through a kind of a design process, you know, which is kind of instinct and collage and brief, and you don't really understand some of the implications or the reasons why you did it in the first place. And then you finish doing it, and you're like, oh my goodness, that's why I did that. That was about, you know, and so the kind of the interest, the innovation for that really came through that sort of feeling of responsibility and understanding that as architects, we need to understand the implications of our actions and that we need to be part of the solution and not part of the problem.
I want to ask you about a couple of projects you and your firm did. Murray Grove.
Yeah.
Right. So that's an 8-story.
Nine-story. Yeah.
Housing.
Yep. 9-story social housing and private for sale housing.
And it is made of?
Timber. Mass timber, so engineered timber, called cross-laminated timber, which is planks of a regular spruce tree, secondary grade planks, so the stuff that used to get pulped into paper. Mm-hmm. The planks are laid out, they're sprayed with a PV adhesive, so very less than 1% of the volume of the panel is adhesive, and then those layers are built up and formed into panels, which are, you know, say, approximately, I'm just trying to convert from metric to imperial in my head, and it's 3 times 16. So about 40 foot.
Right.
So about 40 foot by 12 foot wide. So massive panels. And then those panels are, depending what the job of that panel is, that's how thick they are. So anything from sort of 3 or 4 inches up to 2 foot thick. And that panel then goes into a cutting machine, and whatever the architect draws on their CAD program, mm-hmm. that same file goes to the factory, and that's how the panels are cut out. And then they arrive on site with all the windows cut out, with all the services chased into them, roof profile, whatever it is. And they come on the back of a truck, all piled up, like a kind of, you know, like a sort of a kid's model kit, all packed up. And then a couple of guys, in that case, in Murray Grove, four guys built nine stories in 27 days.
27 days.
27 days. No noise, no rubbish, yeah, and about 30 deliveries.
And it's safe, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I live in, well, the other thing is, I live in a house like that.
Okay.
So I, with two friends, three families built, bought a piece of land in London, and we built a seven-story building. We got three apartments in it, and then we sold off the lower floors for offices and that kind of thing. So I live in one of those buildings. I didn't want to be one of those people who kind of talk and talk and talk about it. You know, as we say in London, you know, if you talk the talk, you've got to walk the walk, right?
Yeah. Is timber more adaptable as well?
Yeah, certainly. I think that, you know...
Flexible and...
Yeah, we're learning. I mean, we really are learning. I'm not going to sit here and say, you know what, I've cracked this. We're learning. We're learning about what kind of architecture this material can produce. And this is, I mean, this is, you know, it's a time in the history of our species that is so incredibly important. And architects have such a major role to play in this. I mean, in many ways, kind of terrifying for our children, you know, what may be ahead for them, but there is an opportunity here to do something about it and actually to create an architecture of real meaning. And I think that that's an incredibly exciting opportunity for us to grasp.
I want to ask you also about Bushy Cemetery,
yeah.
A Jewish cemetery.
Yeah.
And you, part of what you created there was made of rammed earth?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So what we did was, it was one of those kind of bizarre phone calls that you never get. You know, where somebody phoned us up, had seen our work, and was interested in how we approach to brief, how we approach clients, as well as sustainability. And somebody from the chief rabbi's office called me up and said, you know, would you be interested in building a Jewish cemetery? And I was like, yeah, definitely. We'd love to compete for that. And he went, oh, do you think you should compete? I mean, no, I didn't mean that exactly. I mean, yeah, we'd love to do that. So when we got this built, I mean, you know, I'm an urban architect, you know, I'm not, but I went to the countryside where the cemetery is, and, you know, me and this guy, Stephen, we stood in a field full of cabbages, and he said to me, so where do you think we should put the prayer halls? And I'm looking at a field of cabbages going, I don't have a clue.
It's something completely different.
Yeah,
right?
Completely different. I mean, you know, usually my job is to kind of build buildings on a very specific kind of lot, pre-carved out lot. And I extrude that plan and get as many apartments or as big an office or a health center or school or whatever it is onto that site. But to go onto an kind of big cabbage patch, basically, and say, right, where do we start here? But then, you know, things begin to fall into place. There's kind of like, you know, we had a site that fell 28 feet from one side to the other across about 15 acres. So big site. So we knew that there was going to be a lot of civil engineering. And I began, I guess, at the same time as, you know, in the studio drawing the buildings, I began to think about, you know, those trucks kind of plowing through, you know, one after another, taking that soil away from the site, dumping it somewhere else, coming back, you know, all that kind of, and then thinking about, you know, visualizing the idea of loads more trucks coming in with loads more, you know, and it just kind of like, so began to research into thinking about rammed earth, thinking about kind of, I mean, one of the fascinating things about the Jewish faith for me, I'm not Jewish, and one of the fascinating things is that kind of, you know, is that duality that the faith has retained over centuries of a kind of Middle Eastern foundation, you know, from Israel, and a kind of like, and yet a very British nature to the community. So actually thinking about a kind of Middle Eastern construction technology seemed immediately appropriate. The other, I think, beautiful thing about the Jewish faith is how it organizes itself. So there's no, you know, you don't have a priest. I mean, I was brought up Catholic. There's nobody anointed by God to take care of you that you have to call father. You know, you hire a rabbi, you know, and if he doesn't sing as well as you want him to sing, you sack him, you know, you fire the guy. So right. So it's much more kind of democratic, actually, type, you know, faith based around a democratic organization, which is really rather lovely. And You know, I think that, and also you don't have any typology. So there's no spires, there's no domes, there's no, you know, it's actually, you know, it's a basic shelter. And the shelter shouldn't detract from the kind of from the seriousness of the occasion. It should perhaps add to the kind of, you know, to your sense of empathy within the occasion and all that kind of, but it doesn't have to be a specific shape. So when we started thinking about the forms of these buildings within the landscape, the idea that you would actually build the building from the earth that was around it to celebrate a physical body and a memory of a departed soul. The idea that you're about to, you see, the other thing in the Jewish faith is that you bury people in perpetuity. You know, you look after that graveside in perpetuity. So the Jewish faith promises to look after your grave. So once the cemetery is full, then you move on. And the cemetery that we have will last about 70 years, you know, hopefully around the same as me. So you kind of like, nobody's buried on top of each other, nobody's exhumed, that kind of thing. So that relationship with the soil, you know, from whence you came to where you will go, you know, even the word in Hebrew for soil is similar to the word for man, you know, it's kind of, so it's a very, and when you bury somebody, I lost a friend who was Jewish just after we completed the building, and I that connection to the earth, when you're filling the grave in, you know, when you're standing by the side of the grave with a shovel and you're filling that in, and then you go back to the prayer hall afterwards to say a prayer, you're covered in that soil, you know, and you're standing there and covered in the soil, surrounded by a building made of that soil. You know, the funny thing, the other thing about going to a funeral is that the kind of, you know, the professed process of going to a funeral is to celebrate the person that's died. And yet we all know that actually we spend a lot of the time when we're at a funeral thinking about our own mortality, you know, and what's going to happen to us. So actually to be surrounded by earth, to have very kind of sensorial, elemental kind of surrounding to you, I think is very important for that process.
Is it ever terrifying for you when you come, because you strike me as an incredibly curious and inquisitive person, but when you come up with these ideas, these concepts, these new projects, is there ever a moment of terror that, oh, what am I doing? Will this work?
Somebody asked me that. You know, one of the funny things is we were kind of like amusing anecdote is that when we first mooted this idea of round earth, we met with a UK contractor who professed to build rammed earth buildings. Mm-hmm. And we built a wall in the car park of the adjacent farm that's owned by the rabbi's office. And we built this wall, and then the chief rabbi and some of his staff were coming the next morning to have a look at the wall. And we had a massive rainstorm that night. And when we arrived in the car park, there was a big lump of mud just sat in the car park. And I'm standing in front of this lump of mud. The chief rabbi's looking at me going, "It will be all right, Andrew, won't it? It will be all right." And I'm going, "Yeah, not a problem. You know, because I've got like our planning consent, you know, from the local city, which says this is a rammed earth building, you know, and we're staring at a lump of mud, you know, and he's thinking, well, if I got to start burying people in about 8 months' time because I haven't got any more space left, do you know all that?
Right.
So there was a bit of pressure, I will say. But we had this wonderful engineer, and she just went online and she found this guy in Australia who was building rammed earth buildings in the Margaret River in southwestern Australia, which has not a dissimilar climate to the UK. She Skyped him. He happened to be on holiday in France. We flew him over and he arrived at our studio, you know, looking like Crocodile Dundee. I mean, I swear to God, like kind of, you know, sort of shorts and big boots and stuff and a hat and good day, like that to everybody. And he was just the most genius person. He was fantastic. He was so enthusiastic. And within 6 months, he had arrived on site with another Australian guy and a shipping container full of kind of specialist sort of formwork and that kind of thing. He arrived on site. He went down to the local unemployment center. He found four local lads. He trained them up in 2 days, and the six of them built four buildings in 3 months. It was just amazing to see. It was so exciting.
Are you encouraged about the future?
Whoa, that's a good one. I mean, you know what? I have kids, right? So I must be. I kind of, you know, I do. it's serious, and it's kind of, you know, just as I was coming out here from the UK, there was a report in the UK that the number of mammals in the UK has been reduced by 25% since 1970, when I was a kid, right? When I was, you know, growing up in the countryside outside of London. And, it, you know, you see it. You visibly see there are fewer birds in the sky. You know, there are less animals in the woods. And that's, you know, when I'm walking with my little girls, that's sad. You know, that makes me really upset. But, you know, I'm lucky enough to be a middle-aged white guy. So this is in my, you know, this is my job, you know. And I only mean that because, you know, I have a voice that can be heard, right? That's the truth of the situation. And I need to use that voice. I think that I wouldn't be able to forgive myself if I didn't use that voice. You know, so I am optimistic. I think we can do this. And I think that we can have, I think that we can, not only we can, you know, reduce the impacts of climate change, slow it down. I also think that this can produce a better society. And I think that this, you know, a more caring society, a more friendly, benevolent society. And I think that actually, you know, we could have a better future from this, you know, terrible crisis that we're in.
Thank you so much for your time.
Pleasure.
Andrew Waugh is a founding director of Waugh Thistleton Architects in London, and he was in Fayetteville this past weekend to participate in a symposium regarding design excellence in timber and wood, hosted by the Faye Jones School of Architecture and Design at the University of Arkansas and the U.S. Forest Service.
KUAF is supported by the Farmer's Table Cafe, serving locally sourced farm-to-table breakfast and lunch Tuesday through Sunday, located at 1079 South School Avenue in Fayetteville. TheFarmersTableCafe.com for menus and more. Walton Arts Center presents The Complete Works of William Shakespeare, Abridged, Thursday, October 17th at 7 p.m. Three men in tights use wacky antics to take on the seemingly impossible task of performing each of Shakespeare's 37 plays in just 97 minutes. Tickets and more information available at waltonartscenter.org or 443-5600.
And thanks for spending part of your Tuesday with Ozarks at Large. The machinations related to a possible impeachment of the President of the United States alter, switch, and contort almost every hour. In his Arkansas Democrat Gazette column Sunday, John Brummett addressed the latest developments by invoking a phrase first made famous in the state by a former Arkansas Razorback football coach. This week, in his conversation with Roby Brock from our partner Talk Business and Politics, he elaborates.
Just as a matter of course, impeachment is a political process based on undefined high crimes and misdemeanors borrowed from English and American common law that refers to a general abuse of authority. And Alexander Hamilton himself said this is not something for which you have to have a criminal citation. It's a political action based on an unfitness to serve, and it's a political decision. Therefore, you don't have to have a citation in the criminal code. So I was seeking to explain that. But then I said, in a way, it's the comparison I chose, which I thought would be meaningful to at least to older Arkansans, I forget how old I am, is the do right rule, where Lou Holtz suspended three star players 2 weeks before an Orange Bowl game against number two Oklahoma and didn't want to say, on advice of counsel or whatever, what they were accused of doing or why. And he said to badgering reporters, they broke the do right rule, which has become part of, I thought, part of the state lexicon. It simply means whether there's a law, whether there's a rule, you got to do right.
You know better.
You know better.
Yeah.
And call a foreign leader and then openly ask the Chinese, hey, investigate this guy who may well be my general election opponent. Investigate him. And by the way, we're going to have a lot of leverage if we have these trade talks with China coming up. And by the way, I know you want this money, Ukraine. Doesn't say them in the same sentence to avoid it. Basically, that's a pretty clear violation of the do right rule, as even Republicans will attest. And I'm just saying the Democrats have the right and the justification, should they choose, and I'm not sure that they should, to go forward with impeachment on what is sort of a big stakes do right rule violation. The Republicans might want to join in impeachment right now, considering Trump's overnight announcement that he's going to join the rather authoritative regime in Turkey. and oblige a Russian position as well, to abandon the Kurds, our best friends in Syria and fighting ISIS, and just pull back and let Turkey do what it wishes. Even got Lindsey Graham, a flitter, on Fox, you know, saying, trying to, almost as if he's talking, Mr. President, I can't get you on the phone, so I'm going on Fox. Please. Please, I can't tell you what a mistake this
is. Executive time, John. It's executive
time. It's a bizarre action, seemingly out of the blue. And it, again, if we are to pursue a theme, it suggests that Trump admires authoritarian regimes and authoritarian actions more than cooperative international alliances that are more typical of our country. It's a big part of who he is and what he is. So, who knows where and who knows where this thing's going on impeachment? Otherwise, we got a second whistleblower. We got other officials who may want to sign on and say we're aware of this thing that the whistleblower alleged. It's people who say they know how this is going to end, do not, because this is moving fast and towards some sort of collision. I think
this is why you see some complicated GOP messaging. You have some staunch defenders of the president who have come out and basically thrown spaghetti at the wall. You've got a few that have tried to slough it off, like a Marco Rubio. It's like, he wasn't serious about that.
Yeah, no, he was joking.
He was pretty serious about that, I think.
He's just talking.
And then you have some that are just stone cold silent, mm-hmm. which probably is the best tactic at this point in time, because you don't know what's about to happen.
They need a message, but you know what you need? Even the best spin doctoring, even the best messaging is going to require a point and a virtue, even if it's only an element. They can't. The president is out of control. He says crazy things. We all knew it. We're not going to. We understand the politics. This is the Republican view, I think. We understand the politics of it, which is that the base is solid and this may and the Democratic action may backfire on them. But we don't want to get. We don't want ourselves to get too aligned with him because there may be more coming out with subpoena power and who knows.
John Brummett is a political writer for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, and his columns, including a Wednesday digital-only column, can also be found at arkansasonline.com. He talked with Roby Brock, who is with our partner, Talk Business and Politics. There is more from their conversation at talkbusiness.net. This is Ozarks at Large.
On Radiolab, you'll hear a lot of this.
No.
This whole notion is totally wrong.
Really?
But I thought...
No.
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 Wait.
Not quite.
But Einstein tells you...
That to me just seems...
But so...
Jeez.
Come on.
But you'll also hear a lot of this.
Yes.
I think that's absolutely right.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's right.
That's the ticket.
Tune in to Radiolab to hear us grapple with and sometimes understand the world's mysteries.
We're excited to tell you Radiolab joins the KUAF schedule beginning this weekend. You'll be able to hear Radiolab every Saturday afternoon at 2 on 91.3 beginning this Saturday. Then stay tuned at 3 Saturday for the new time for Hidden Brain. And don't worry, Latino USA is still on KUAF. It's moving to Sunday afternoons at 3, also beginning this week. And you can find our complete weekend schedule at KUAF.com. This weekend, you can find a legend celebrating another legend at the Walton Arts Center. Freddie Cole, who will mark his 88th birthday next week, will be on stage to observe the centennial year of the birth of Nat King Cole, Freddie's older brother. Freddie Cole has established his own voice over the past 7 decades. He'll bring the Freddie Cole Quartet to the Star Theater Saturday night at 7:30. Recently, Robert Ginsburg, the host of KUAF's Shades of Jazz, spoke with Freddie Cole.
Well, Mr. Cole, this is maybe your first performance in Northwest Arkansas, is that right?
It is, it is.
Well, it's about time, I'd say. I'd like to talk a little bit about your background, just for folks who may not be that familiar with you. I know you grew up in Chicago, and and you were quoted as saying music was all around you, but I also get the sense it was never really pushed on you. It was just part of the environment you grew up in.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. You know, it was never pushed on any of us. Just one of those God-given things, you know.
You were the youngest sibling in a family of, were there five kids?
Yeah, five.
And all of your brothers were performers on one level or another, weren't they?
Yeah, and my sister, she played piano, and her daughter played it. This thing ran through the family.
Of course, the most famous member of the family was your brother, Nat Cole, also known as Nat King Cole.
Right.
Your household was frequented by some rather important figures in music who I assume were friends with Nat. And by famous people, I mean musicians like Duke Ellington, Count Basie, and Lionel Hampton. These cats just would show up at the house on occasions when they were touring, or how did that work?
Yeah, when they'd be through Chicago, you know, they'd stop by. My mom would cook a meal or something, or they'd stop by and, you know, just do things that musicians do, you know, hang out.
Friends and family.
Yeah.
Did you develop any long-term friendships with any of these guys?
Yeah, I did. Not actually personal relationship, but they knew me, and they just called me Little Cole, you know, and when I would see them when I was in New York, and it was very useful to know that you had these guys as a backbone of what you were doing. If they see you on the street, they pull your coat. Hey, Little Cole, watch that. Don't do that. Just little things like that that an adult would do to a youngster.
Help you keep the wheels between the ditches, I guess, on occasion.
Yeah, exactly.
You went on and studied music formally. Was there ever a time in your life where you thought you might do something else?
You know, I never even thought about it, you know. No. It's one of those things that just kept evolving naturally, I guess. I've got the blues before sunrise. Tears standing in my
eyes. Got the blues before sunrise. Tears standing in my eyes. Oh, it's such a miserable feeling, a feeling that I do despise. It feels like everybody's down on me. Feels like everybody's down on me. I'm gonna drown my troubles in the deep blue sea. You're going to be touring with some old friends and some guys that you've been working with more recently, and also notably with your son Lionel Cole, who's going to be helping out on piano, and is he's going to be singing with you as well?
Yeah, he does both, you know, and he's been living in Australia, and he does an interesting job. Enjoy him.
I was going to ask you, what's it like performing with your son?
It's been very funny. I've played with him before, you know, but this particular trip, you know, to see how much he is advanced. If he hangs in there with it, you know, it's not an easy job, but you'll get your just due.
Having an older brother like Nat King Cole is sort of a mixed blessing for you, I guess. I know you were very forceful in developing your own career. You didn't want to live in his shadow or have expectations that you were going to emulate him. In fact, you even had a recording that you made some years back called I'm Not My Brother, I'm Me. But in the last year or so, you've really been embracing his legacy. And one of the reasons being you've just reached that point in your career where you don't really have to prove anything. You've proved so much already. but also it's the centennial of Nat King Cole. So you've been celebrating his legacy and embracing a lot of his music.
Yeah, you fight it for a long while, then you come to a realization is the best you can do is the best you can, and find something to present. You know, a lot of people just don't, they're great musicians and entertainers, but they don't know how to present what they do. And so I just worked on that and carved out a little niche for myself, tiny spot within the heart, you know. And we worry about swinging. That's what's happening.
That's where the focus of attention should be, I think.
That's right. We worry about swinging.
Love like this can't last. Your sweet kiss is too good to be true. No matter what I do, I know that love like this can't last. Hey, this romance won't end. This sweet dance will soon be history. All of eternity, I'm sure that love like this can't last. Yeah, but I'm a fool. I get brave and bolder when trouble begins to appear. So I'm gonna play it cool when the girl on my shoulder whispers sweet things in my ear. Love like this won't last. It's a fair, it's far beyond belief. It's bound to hit a reef. I know that love like this can last.
When you perform now, do you plan your sets, or do you hit the stage and decide what you're going to do? How do you format your shows these days?
I don't never know what I'm going to play. if I go by the way the crowd feels.
Your repertoire is timeless. I mean, what is it about that repertoire you think that has made it so long-lasting?
That's a great question. I listen to Sinatra Station all the time, and they play me on there quite a bit. But I just try to reach out and touch someone. If I can touch somebody with my music, you know, if it's 20 people there and I touch one, I've done my job.
So it's about connecting.
Mm-hmm.
And making people feel it.
Yeah.
I'm with you 100% there. You're going to be here in Northwest Arkansas on October 12th, and that's very close to your 88th birthday, October 15th.
Right. I never thought I'd get this old.
As you look back on your career and look forward, how does it feel to be at this place in time? There's always nostalgia, and there's always looking back, remembering times, but there's also looking forward still, touring with your son. Being able to create this music has got to be a great feeling for you.
Oh, yeah. As you said before, it's a blessing, you know, and you take it as such and keep on moving. So I think life has been beautiful. So I have no complaints and no regrets. Still believe in chasing dreams and placing bets.
Mr. Cole, thank you again.
I'll just tell you this. Keep hope alive and keep jazz alive.
Who could forget that velvet voice so warm? Thoughts turned to love as he would sing. He gave of himself from the day he was born.
Freddie Cole speaking with Robert Ginsberg. Robert is the host of KUAF's Shades of Jazz. That conversation took place in advance of the Freddie Cole Quartet's tribute to Nat King Cole Centennial Saturday night at Walton Arts Center. You can find out more at waltonartscenter.org. And you can hear Shades of Jazz with Robert Ginsberg each Friday night at 10 on 91.3 KUAF.
He touched in every land. Who could begin to count the ways? He spread such love, he spread such joy, even today.
He was the king, second to none. Throughout the world, he was the one with so much class. He had such grace, a certain style, a friendly smile upon his face. Now who could forget that velvet?
This is Ozarks at Large.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. Theater Squared presents the comedy Native Gardens, where good fences don't always make good neighbors. Tanya and Pablo move next door to Virginia and Frank, a deep-rooted couple with an impeccably trim backyard. When a questionable fence line puts Frank's prize-worthy garden in jeopardy, a rivalry soon escalates into a comedic, all-out border dispute. Performances Tuesday through Sunday, now through November 10th, 777-7477, or theater2.org for tickets and information.
It's time for the Milton Grammarian on Ozarks at Large. Milton Grammarian's Catherine Shields. Welcome back.
Thanks. Kyle, I want to talk about a couple of questions we've gotten from listeners.
Oh, good.
Ron Norvell asked if we had covered the use of may versus might.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Ron, I don't really know whether we have or not, but if I can't remember, maybe no one else will either.
Right.
Grammar Girl writes that in popular usage and speech, may and might are used interchangeably when referring to possibility and probability. But there is a slight difference between the two.
Okay.
And let me tell you, it's slight. When you get down to some of these things, it's pretty darn slight. May is used to express what is possible, factual, or could be factual.
It may rain tomorrow?
Mm-hmm. Might is used to express what is hypothetical, counterfactual, or remotely possible.
Okay, so let me see if I've got this. We'll use my example.
Mm-hmm.
It may rain tomorrow. I've read the forecast, and there's a 70% chance. It might rain tomorrow because, hell, it might rain any day.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Or even it might not rain because right. they've said it right. wouldn't, or maybe.
There might be a rhinoceros around the corner.
Right. That's yeah. a good example. An easy way to express the difference is that might suggests a lower probability than does may.
Okay.
You could say might is for things that are mighty far-fetched.
All right.
That's a way to remember it.
Very good.
Kyle, I guess I might have known this next rule, but I might not have. Now, why did I use might instead of may?
Tell me.
what did we just talk about?
Well,
thinking about might is mighty.
Is hypothetical.
Far-fetched.
Or, right.
Mighty
right,
far-fetched. Okay. So I used might instead of may because it's so far-fetched that I would have known this grammar
okay.
rule.
Okay, I got you.
The rule is that might is the past tense of may.
Huh?
Yeah.
Wait,
yeah.
what?
Yeah.
I might have.
No.
No, just might.
Just may have.
What?
No, you're right. You're
okay.
right. Might have, yeah,
okay.
might have. Not may have.
Okay.
Not may have.
Okay.
And I use that
I may have. Oh, I might
I may have known that.
But I might have is.
I might have known that.
Well,
mm-hmm. yeah.
Interesting.
If you can determine the tense of your sentence, you can easily choose between might and may, if you
mm-hmm.
remember.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
According to the American Heritage Dictionary's 2012 usage panel survey, the vast majority of experts disagree with using might have and may have in the same context.
Mm.
AHD provided their panel with the two following sentences, and this is also the two sentences that Ron sent. If John Lennon had not been shot, the Beatles might have gotten back together. If John Lennon had not been shot, the Beatles may have gotten back together.
Based on what you've told me so far, might would be the right one.
That's
because
right.
we have no idea.
That's right, yeah.
They might not
yeah.
have either.
Yeah,
yeah.
yeah. And more simply, may have should not be used.
Right.
The,
right, because there's no correct way
to use
put that
may have.
In that situation.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
Right, because it's past tense.
Yeah.
In the survey, 97% of the usage panelists found the first sentence to be acceptable, might have, mm-hmm. while only 32% found the second sentence to be acceptable. I know I'm guilty of this, and I'll try to watch it from now on, but totally, you know. When asking for permission, may is more common than might. While both of these words can be used to ask permission, if you're not careful, they can lead to ambiguity. For instance, I may not go to the movies tonight.
Okay.
What does that mean?
You
has two meanings.
You oh right, you're not allowed.
Yes.
Or you just there's a possibility you won't be going to the movies.
Right. And your mama won't let you.
Yeah. Yeah.
or the first. That's, right. That's the first one. So in that instance, you want to say I might not go to the movies, and that's much clearer. If that's the meaning, and if your mama told you not to, then it's different. The second email I'll address is a question about the use of the phrase the late.
Yes. How, when is some,
Yeah. And I asked you about this, and you said you think maybe somebody just walked up to you and asked you about it.
Oh, I get that a lot. Uh-huh. Like, hey, you know, I'm at a restaurant or something. Hey, I love the Milton Grammarian. Will you ask her about this? I think this is one of those situations. How long can you use the term the late to refer to someone who has passed along?
Right. So you might say the late President Gerald Ford, but would you say the late Abraham Lincoln?
And that was kind of where this person was going.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. There is no set limit as to how long one can refer to a deceased person as late, but the consensus of opinion seems to hover around 15 to 30 years. But there's certainly not anything.
And this is why I should take these to you, because I think what I told the person, like, where would this come from, was I thought it might be used to avoid confusion. Like,
well,
everyone
absolutely.
Knows George Washington
absolutely.
Is dead.
Absolutely.
But you might not know that your neighbor's brother-in-law.
That's exactly right.
And so,
that's what I said. A woman who refers to my husband might mislead an audience if he had died 40 years ago, whereas if she says my late husband, it would be clearer.
Okay. So the late Julius Caesar, I mean, that's that's superfluous.
The late William Sapphire, and I knew he was dead, but other people might not, who died at age 79 and was an all-around expert on speech, suggested 15 years.
But
nothing is set down. But finally, I found this rather grim limerick. There was a young man in a car who said to his father, Papa, if you drive at this rate, we will surely be late. Drive faster. He did, and they are.
I mean, I feel weird laughing about that, but and I wonder, now that we've had this conversation, where that came from.
The late?
Yeah.
Well, it's nicer than the dead.
Okay. I mean, I imagine you
my dead husband.
You know, Chaucer was waiting for someone who was supposed to be there.
and he died, so that's why he called him.
Late. All right. I don't know why Chaucer. Milton Grammarian is Catherine Sherrills.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week on Latino USA, you might not be able to name any of his songs, but when you hear them, you'll remember you've danced to every single one of them.
Technically, I'm Cuban American, so I'm already politically incorrect.
My revealing conversation with Pitbull. That's this week on Latino USA.
Latino USA, now heard on a new day, Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock. The KUAF weekend schedule is changing a bit with some new shows and a few shows changing times or days. There is a strong emphasis on culture and science. The new NPR program, It's Been a Minute with Sam Sanders, starts this Saturday at 11 a.m. And Radiolab is also going to be part of the 91.3 Saturday schedule, beginning Saturday afternoon at 2. Hidden Brain migrating to Saturday afternoons at 3, beginning this weekend as well. And Travel with Rick Steves moves to Saturday afternoons as well. A complete look at our weekend schedule can be found at KUAF.com. Timothy Dennis mastered our show today from inside the Herald and Blanche Cox News Studio. Our thanks to Robert Ginsburg for talking to Freddie Cole. Robert's Shades of Jazz can be heard Friday nights at 10. And our conversations between Roby Brock from Talk Business and Politics and John Brumma with the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette are part of our partnership with Talk Business and Politics. You can learn more at talkbusiness.net. Our theme is titled First Hurrah. It is written and performed by Daryl Sean. You can find out more about Daryl at his website, darylsean.com. His latest album is titled Safe in Sound. Ozarks at Large is a production of 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and the entirety of the Kings River. 91.3 KUAF is a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Don't forget, you can subscribe to our absolutely free podcast available through Spotify, TuneIn, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, Apple TV, wherever you find your podcasts. Oh, and by the way, you can listen to us through your smart speaker. Just remember to say, play Ozarks at Large through TuneIn. All right, Antoinette Grajeda selects music for us to end many of our shows. Today, we're ending with music from Handmade Moments, recorded just for us inside the Furman Garner Performance Studio. They will be performing at the Hillbury Festival near Eureka Springs this weekend. They're scheduled to play Thursday night and Saturday afternoon. A full schedule of all the artists and their times can be found at hillburyfestival.com. This is their song, Home Sweet Home Again. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Kyle Kellums. We'll be back with another brand new edition of Ozarks at Large tomorrow at noon and 7. Have a great rest of your Tuesday.
For the past, 5 years, and finally me and Anna finished it, so here we go. Home sweet home again. Would you leave in this land? Just excuses and reasons why you can't go find a glorious view of the setting sun. Reasons why you can't.